It says European Union nations have taken sufficient action to avoid sanctions over their trade ties with Iran. Terry Schultz tells us from Brussels the EU will also be imposing stronger measures on itself.
Washington has taken the global lead in cracking down on Iran's oil trade as a way to pressure the regime into giving up any weapons-related nuclear activities. Importers of Iranian oil are subject to U.S. sanctions beginning July 1st. Any banks used for trade with Tehran could be cut off from U.S. activities. Belgium, Britain, France, Germany, and six other EU countries all cut back, but they'd be doing so anyway as the EU's own ban on Iranian oil kicks in July 1st when the American sanctions do. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Libya's former spy chief reportedly will be deported from Mauritania to face trial at home. He's accused of attacking civilians during the uprising last year. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
On the next Fresh Air, science writer Jonah Lehrer explores where innovative ideas come from. He says they rarely come out of company brainstorming meetings. His new book, Imagine How Creativity Works, taps insights from Bob Dylan, Yo-Yo Ma, and Autistic Surfer, and others. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, Hour 2 of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. This hour of the show comes from the Focus Archive. You can listen to many past programs by going there. It's at WILL.illinois.edu. You can also get the schedule for the days and weeks ahead. The program that you'll be hearing was first broadcast on February 1st, so do keep in mind as you listen that for this hour, we will not take calls. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, commonly known as the stimulus, was the biggest economic recovery plan in history. It is estimated to have saved or created millions of jobs, although it did not bring about a strong, sustainable recovery, the kind of thing that really everybody was hoping for. So the question is, was it a success? Was it a failure? In this hour of Focus, we will take up that very question. And our guest for the program is Michael Graybell. He is a reporter at ProPublica and has been since 2008. He's produced stories for USA Today, Salon, NPR, MSNBC, and also the CBS Evening News. And before joining ProPublica, he was a reporter at the Dallas Morning News. He is the author of a new book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is Money Well Spent, and that is with a question mark. That is a question. Money Well Spent. The subtitle is The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, the Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. Public Affairs is the publisher of the book. And it attempts to answer that question. Was it indeed money well spent? And Mr. Graybell, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
The response to the stimulus and to the results of the stimulus has been sharply partisan, polarized in that sort of way, essentially with Democrats arguing that it did prevent an economic collapse on the level of the Great Depression, on the one hand, and Republicans saying that it was just a flat-out failure and that it was just another example of why big government programs and big government spending don't make any sense. So, is that analysis pure politics, or can one make the case that in at some level both sides are correct?
Well, these stark disparities that we see, where we hear two very different things, are mainly politics. And so, mm-hmm. in writing the book, what I wanted to do is get out of the politics and actually see for myself how the money was really spent and see how it affected middle class workers or didn't affect them in some ways. So, there's there is a little bit of both in this. You know, the stimulus did a lot of good, and we'll get into some of those things in the program. But as you said at the start, it ultimately failed to live up to its promise. Hmm.
Well, does that, you know, I think that one of the things that we know is that the president particularly, when things are going well, when the economy is going well, the president gets credit or claims credit. And when the economy is going badly, the president gets the blame. But I think you have to ask this larger question, well, really, truly, really and truly, the president or the federal government, how much control does that person or those persons have, and how, you know, what sort of leverage do they have on the economy?
Well, they do have some. I mean, obviously, traumatic crisis like we've seen with the Great Depression and like we saw with the Great Recession the last few years, have a lot of prevailing things building up over years that cause them to happen. At the same time, there are things presidents can do. That's why we elect them and put a lot of faith in them. The Obama kind of philosophy of government, from Audacity of Hope all the way through the campaign to the last to State of the Union last week, is that the government, you know, in times of great economic challenge, can sow the seeds or create the conditions for a strong economy. And, you know, they talk about the interstate highway system. I mean, so that's sort of been the whole mythology or philosophy about the role of government in the Obama administration.
Hmm. Well, is it possible to make a judgment that says, and again, we can talk about some of the details, but as an overall kind of assessment, make a judgment that says it was certainly not everything that was hoped for, but that things would have been worse if the stimulus plan hadn't come along?
Yeah, I talked to a lot of economists for the book, and what the, you know, there was a lot of different opinions, but what a lot of people said was that if the stimulus had not been passed, we would have seen the unemployment rate go up to 12% or even higher, and that if stay above in double digits much longer, perhaps through the end of 2012.
Well, that's, and maybe here we can talk a little bit about the unemployment rate and what the administration said. And I think maybe one of the things that you've written about is how the administration tried to make the case for the stimulus plan and talk about what they thought that it would achieve, and that they did indeed put some numbers out there, what they thought employment, unemployment, what it was, what it would be, what the effect of the stimulus would be, what the effect would be if there was no stimulus, and that, in fact, maybe the point came when they said we wish that we hadn't actually put any kind of solid number on there, because it turned out that it was more than they had projected, in part because of the timing of things. And in fact, what happened was that the people who wanted to criticize the plan said, well, look at what unemployment is. It's even bigger than what they had estimated that it would be, even if they did nothing. How did all that play out?
Right. So there's, you know, this now infamous projection that the Obama transition team put out, that if we pass a stimulus plan, the unemployment rate will never go above 8%.
Yeah.
And, of course, we know that by the end of February 2009, when the stimulus passed, it was already over 8%. So this plan, this thing called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Plan that was put out, was put together over the Christmas holidays by Dr. Christina Romer, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, our incoming chair, and then Jared Bernstein, who was going to be the economic advisor to the vice president. And if you read the actual analysis, they came pretty close in saying that there'd be about a 2 percentage point difference, that it would, they had a lot of cautions about how little they knew at the time. But, there was a bit of politics involved in wanting to have the administration be extremely transparent, you know, the most transparent administration in history, and the economics of the report maybe not being understandable to a public who hadn't faced a recession like this in a generation. And so a younger staffer had said, why don't we put a chart into this and put it up online? And so Dr. Romer said, okay, I can easily do that on my laptop, on Excel. Here we go. Here's a chart of what it is right now. And that's where we got these estimates that said 8% tops Without it, 9%. And if we, this time, early 2012, we'd be seeing, unemployment rates in the 6% range. So that turned out to be not only not true, but it turned out to be a very poorly conceived mistake by the administration early on.
We have a couple of callers here, and we would be happy to take questions from people who are listening. Let me just take a second for anybody who may just be joining us to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Michael Graybell. He's a reporter at ProPublica, and that is an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. And his book is Money Well Spent, That is a question, asking the question, well, the economic stimulus plan, we call the stimulus, $825 billion worth. The question is, well, was that money well spent? What was the effect? And the book is recently out. Public Affairs is the publisher. So if you want to take a look at it, you can. Questions are certainly welcome. And we've got a couple people here standing by. People can help us just by being brief, but we want to get in as many as we can. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start with someone in Lovington, and that's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Appreciate you being on. I'm confused about where the bailout ends and the stimulus starts. Can you help me out on that, or are they completely different?
Yes. So the bailout and the stimulus are two different things.
Okay.
The bailout was passed in the fall of 2008, right before the election, I believe, and it was focused on helping the banks out who had been going through this financial crisis. Mm-hmm. The stimulus was supposed to be this program that would help middle class or all workers with a number of tax cuts, safety net spending, infrastructure projects, if you remember the term shovel ready, mm-hmm. and then these investments in clean energy and high speed rail and broadband and the Race to the Top education program.
So the stimulus is pretty much completely this current administration's?
Yes.
Okay.
And then the bailout started in the Bush administration and continued in the Obama administration.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. I think it's an excellent question because people, I'm sure, get all these things mixed up together. And you talked a little bit about the various pieces of this thing that we call the stimulus, the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, being some money went to tax cuts. There was some couple of $100 billion on social safety net kind of things. There was money that went to help states with their own budget problems. And there were these things that were devoted to bigger kinds of infrastructure, both short term, the shovel ready, and some of the longer term big ideas that the administration had. Let me pick one of these things and have you talk about social safety net spending. Give me a couple specifics. What exactly does that mean?
Sure. So that includes the unemployment benefits that people received, they extended it through 99 weeks for some folks. It includes the, food stamps. It includes, there's $87 billion that was sent to the states to sort of prop up the Medicaid programs and keep, not turn people away. So all of this spending does create jobs indirectly. So somebody having more money in their pocket for food stamps or because their health care didn't get cut off, they can go to the grocery store and spend money. And so that, down the line, creates jobs for a grocery clerk, or the Medicaid money creates jobs at a nurse so that the clinic doesn't have to lay people off. But that kind of spending is very hard for the public to see, or that kind of job creation is very hard for the public to see. And that's one thing I read about in the book where the administration did a kind of a poor job explaining this. And there could have been a press conference, so they went into a community and spent the whole day walking the public through this and pointing out people who might be not recognizable immediately as a stimulus job, rather than spending a lot of their efforts talking about shovel-ready infrastructure projects that were going to take 6 months to a year to really get going.
Yeah. It seems to me this is a really important point, and that is that so much of the spending was it went into subtle things, or at least things that people didn't really notice right away, and that the administration, your suggestion is the administration really missed the opportunity to sell the plan a little bit more, or at least to say, look, here is what it did. Here is what it did for your community, and that maybe made it easier for people who wanted to say, well, it really didn't do much of anything.
Right, and I talked to an Obama advisor in the book, or former Obama advisor now, who says, he kind of created this alternative reality for me and said, what if we had passed a stimulus that was really, really focused on certain things and didn't include all those other investments where the money was spread out far and wide? Then the administration could come and say, hey, I'm the new president. I cut your taxes. I saved your teachers. I saved police officers in town. Aren't I a great guy? I built a road in your town, maybe, or I'm going to build a road in your town. And then, the administration could have really focused on an investment package that wouldn't have just been a down payment, but would have been something more substantial that the could have been longer lasting and could have had more support or more bipartisan support from Republicans.
Yeah. Maybe just one other quick point, and then I have a caller I want to get to. I think that a lot of people, when they think about the stimulus, when they think about what the intent was supposed to be, they do think about infrastructure. They think about the idea that what this was supposed to do was to fix things and to build things. And Lord knows that we have been told often enough that the infrastructure in this country, so we are talking about things like roads and bridges and municipal water systems and the electricity grid and so many things, we're told that it's not in good shape, it's old, it's not up to the burden that is placed on it now. So I think people think about this as being about infrastructure. But in fact, when you take a look at where all the money went, not that much actually went into infrastructure.
Yeah, in comparison to the whole package, I mean, it was less than $100 billion. So that's less than 15% of the package went to infrastructure projects. And that's including everything, like you said, not just your roads and highways, but also things like smart grid or cleaning up contaminated waste sites. So with the infrastructure spending, there was less than $100 billion. There wasn't. I guess my point on this is the American Society of Civil Engineers came out with this report right as the stimulus was coming out, saying that if they were to grade American infrastructure, they'd give it a D.
Mm-hmm.
When I spoke to a construction economist when he looked at all the spending, he said, we did, the stimulus money was spent on all these different things, but if it even put a plus on that D, I'd be surprised.
Yeah. We have another caller here. Our next is in Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Hello. I see two major failures in this stimulus or recovery, whatever you want to, however you want to term it. First of all, the banks should have shouldered at least 50 to 70% of the bad loans. They made the bad loans. It's their responsibility. And they got paid, I think, 100% on the dollar. The second one is Goldman Sachs was not fined or penalized for selling paper to applicants and then taking the other taking the other side of the loan or whatever they sold. And they were not penalized, but they failed in their fiduciary interest to be righteous about to the applicant, and they failed on full disclosure. And as a result, since they did not get penalized, now we have Freddie Mac doing the same thing, working at cross purposes with the applicants, in that they make more money if they don't refinance the home loans, because they've already sold off the securities, and now all they have for profit is 7% interest. If they refinance, they won't get as much interest. So there are two aspects I think were really failures in the recovery.
Okay. Well, right. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, just to clarify again, the things you're talking about and the frustration you're feeling has to do with the bank bailout that we saw, and the stimulus and the Recovery Act, as I said, the money did not go to banks per se. It was for these infrastructure projects and safety net spending. But I will take this opportunity to put in a plug for a colleague here at ProPublica who wrote that Freddie Mac story, and you can read more about some of the questionable practices that banks were doing in the middle of the recession If you go to our website at ProPublica.org.
All right. Well, other questions and comments are welcome. And again, as we've said, the guest here is Michael Graybell. He's a reporter at ProPublica, has been there since 2008. And as he said, if you're interested in finding out more about ProPublica, which is an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative work in the public interest, you can go to their website, which, as he says, is ProPublica.org. And if you want to read about the stimulus, you can look at the book that Michael Graybell has written. It's just out, Money Well Spent? It's a question, and it's published by Public Affairs. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to take a couple of steps back, I feel fairly confident that probably every review and every interview that you have done at some point has mentioned just how big this program was in terms of dollars. And you write about it in the book, that if you look at other big things that the United States has done, all going back to the New Deal and then looking at things like the Manhattan Project and the Marshall Plan, that in just in pure dollar terms, that the stimulus was bigger.
Right. So this was the biggest economic recovery plan in history. But besides that, when you look at all these major programs in history, like the Moon Race, the Manhattan Project, the WPA, the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II, adjusted for inflation, the stimulus was all of these things, or was bigger than all of these things.
Yeah.
And despite this, it's been difficult for the public to know, you know, really what to make of the stimulus because they've been hearing these two different stories. But that's sort of the central question is here, is if it was bigger than these things, what did we get? Well, we remember it in history in the same way that we remember these other big programs.
Well, one thing certainly, again, the next point to be made is you have to also take into consideration that while it, in fact, it is bigger than all of those other things, the government also is bigger now than it was. So that means that it's perhaps you have to consider that when you're thinking about the total amount of money that was spent.
Right. When the New Deal was passed, you know, during the Great Depression, we had budgets that were about, you know, in real dollars at the time, it's about $3 billion. Now we're at about $3 trillion in real dollars, again, not adjusted for inflation. But the important thing here is that the WPA was many times what the annual budget was, two or three times the annual budget in the 1930s. The stimulus package at $825 billion is only about a quarter of what we spend every year on our federal budget when you include things like Social Security and healthcare spending. So while the New Deal programs were kind of like going from zero to 60, the stimulus is really, you know, far less noticeable, maybe like going from 35 miles per hour to 50.
Yeah. And certainly to all of us, $825 billion is a lot of money. Well, yeah, it is. But at the same time, as people in the administration were thinking about this and talking about this and trying to figure out what they were going to do, there certainly were people who were saying that if you really wanted to have impact, that what you should be spending is, they were talking in figures well over $1 trillion. So this gets to this question of the total amount that was spent and whether one can come to some kind of a judgment as to whether that was not enough. And some people would argue that the reason that the program didn't have greater impact was that we didn't spend enough.
Right. And the pure kind of economic theory behind stimulus, what, you know, says that it wasn't the New Deal that saved us from the Great Depression. It was the massive amount of spending as part of the buildup for World War II.
Yeah.
And so now with the stimulus, people are saying, well, $800 billion was really not enough. The economists of the stripe, it really should have been $2 trillion is what we needed. But you think about these numbers and you think about how much spending was needed under the stimulus theory, you're really talking about numbers that today may be politically untenable. You don't have a war going on. It's this sort of massive rollout in the same way. We do have a war going on, but you don't have the same massive rollout for World War II. So it kind of raises questions about what are the limits of this? If we were to follow pure stimulus Keynesian theory, you would say, put a ton of money into this, but then the politics would always be fighting back against you, so you might not get that full amount. And are there other things that you could be doing in addition to stimulus spending that would also have a great effect?
So at least as far as the dollars were concerned, the administration felt that $825 billion, that was what they could get.
Right. But it was also something that at the time was seen as very large. The Senator Collins, who was one of the key moderate senators from, you know, she's from Maine, she's a Republican, one of the key moderate senators, went into some of her meetings with President Obama thinking that $600 billion was the right amount of money. And in these meetings, the president made a strong case and urged her to think higher. And really, through his own one-on-one discussions with some of these senators, convinced them that this $800 billion number was, or I think at they were talking at some point that $900 billion was the right amount of spending that needed to happen.
Just to, again, to underline, I suppose, the political dimensions, though, here, it is worth making the point that when all the votes were counted in all of the Congress, only three, I believe this is correct, only three Republicans, and they were all Republican senators, only three Republicans voted for the stimulus.
That's true. It was nobody in the House
nobody
of Representatives
in the House.
And three Republican senators. The interesting point, though, is that, I think our current political gridlock has kind of turned our memory a bit in thinking that it's always been this way. And they're really, you know, despite what we now remember as the Republicans always having a stand against the stimulus and always having a stand against Obama, going into the administration, there was, the atmosphere was maybe kinder to the current president, as we might remember. Senator McConnell stood up and said, you know, this bipartisanship, you know, doesn't just rest on the president itself. It rests on all of us. And in the negotiations, there were 10 Republicans who were seriously having these discussions about stimulus spending. The opposition wasn't against a stimulus at all. It was against this particular stimulus.
Yeah, just one more thing. I want to go back to the Keynesian, the basic Keynesian idea that underlies the whole principle of the whole idea of stimulus. And this is not a new idea; it's been around for a while. The idea being that in an economic downturn, that the government can stimulate the economy by spending money. Essentially, what they're doing is by spending money, they're putting that money into the pockets of citizens because either one hopes they're creating jobs or they're preserving jobs. You know, the people are doing what they do, whether that's they're being teachers or they're helping to pave roads or whatever. So that money goes into people's pockets, and then it doesn't stay in their pocket. It comes out because they use it. They then spend it in their community. And then not only does that money recirculate, and in fact, there's a way of thinking about it actually gets bumped up. So that's sort of the basic idea. Are there any people now, though, that are really questioning the basic idea underlying this and saying, well, does that really work that way?
Yes, and this has been, Keynes, the economist, was very much out of favor as the stimulus was heading out. And, you know, the Reagan administration came in, and so there was a whole different philosophy of economics. But Keynes kind of made this resurgence through the Obama administration and the stimulus. The conservative Republicans have essentially put up the stimulus as why this whole idea is a failure and not either never was a good plan or the way our current government works it's no longer a tenable theory. Despite what you might think of economics as a social science, there are definitely different political schools of thought, or at least schools of thought, about this theory.
In this hour of focus, our guest is Michael Graybell. He's a reporter at ProPublica. This is an independent, nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. And he has written a book that takes a look at the stimulus that is officially known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, and poses the question, was it money well spent? In fact, that's the title of the book, Money Well Spent. Public Affairs is the publisher. We will take some more calls, and the next person in line is in Urbana. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to the previous caller for just a second about the bank bailout. I rather agree with him that it wasn't done as well as it should have been. I favor the Swedish program of nationalizing the banks and then straightening them out and selling them back to the public. But, and this is a big but, the bailout, as you actually previously stated, was not Obama, as his critics would like us to believe. It was George Bush. The other thing is in regard to Keynesian policy. Roosevelt was quite successful with it in the period 33 to 36. Then he tried to pay down the national debt. And in the second period, there was a retraction, which he attempted to counteract with more spending, but was blocked. And although he brought the unemployment down from about 25% to under 10, if you count the WPA workers, it was very difficult then until the Second World War, when we did have very heavy spending and the depression was finally broken. There's another point about Keynesian policy that is never mentioned, and that Bush in particular violated. In times of prosperity, Keynes would have you pay down the national debt, and this hold down bubbles and such. Nobody seems to want to pay attention to this. I'd appreciate your comments.
Well, okay. You can comment in any way you feel you can.
Sure. These are all good points. WPA and the other programs in the New Deal did bring it down as the sort of basic numbers are 25% to 14%. And then, as you had mentioned, if you count the WPA role, as it goes under 10%. But it wasn't that, you know, I don't really have too much to say about this because I think you make all good points. On the bank bailouts, it's something not that I have spent. I feel less comfortable talking about it because, like, unlike the stimulus, I didn't spend 3 years researching it. But no, I think those are all valid points, and I appreciate your input.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because I think that for a lot of people, as they think about this business of what government can do to rebuild a slumping economy, they do think about the New Deal. Well, one of the big differences was that what happened in the Roosevelt administration was the government actually was the employer. In this particular case, I think the Obama administration, was really committed to the idea of the private sector being the one to create the jobs. They didn't want people working for the government. They wanted to have that money out there so that then private employers could do things, and then they would be the ones that would be the employers. Was there, in fact, any kind of serious discussion in the administration, though, about something that would have been like the WPA?
Yeah, this is a big question. You know, why didn't the administration just do another WPA?
Mm-hmm.
And Jared Bernstein, who was the vice president's chief economic advisor, was a real big advocate of this in a book he wrote before the Great Recession, in which he said that not only in times of economic recession would it make a lot of sense to have this program, but it also might make a lot of sense in times when there is stuff going on, but there are economic problems, such as certain low-income people who have just gotten out of jail, who have no, who are often left out of the labor market or have difficulties finding a job. It's a way to solve that problem. So in the administration, this really didn't get a lot of attention. There was this, or didn't even get a lot of discussion. There was this general idea that they needed to emphasize that the stimulus was going to create private sector jobs, and they kept repeating this for the fear of being a Democratic administration and that they would be seen as just far-left liberals. At the same time, there's a new reality in the way government works today than it did in the 1930s, where, when you build a construction project, you can't just go pick up anybody off the street and say, "Hi, here, join my crew," because now there are regulations, there's training that has to happen, there are skills you have to have, there's heavy equipment that isn't just, it's harder to use than just a sledgehammer and a pickaxe. So there's these big differences that make just a pure work program difficult. But that's not to say that, we didn't see it in the stimulus program. There was a very small pot of money called under the emergency, you know, under the welfare spending, essentially, the emergency jobs fund. And states could create these programs where if they had some small small tasks, unskilled tasks like raking leaves on a highway median or you know, basic things around town that needed to be done, private sector or public sector, that the local government and the state would support those jobs temporarily. And so we saw this, I'll keep going just briefly, in Perry County, Tennessee, for example, saw a big auto supplier go out of business and lay off hundreds of workers. They put this to use and immediately saw their unemployment rate go down. So there was some of this that was pretty successful in the stimulus, but it was done on a very small scale.
We have some other callers here. Time is moving along, so I want to get back to the phones. We'll go to Champaign County next. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. The name of Reagan gets invoked a lot, and it's important, I think, to note that he was a Keynesianist. He was a military Keynesianist and was spending so much money on defense industries that it stimulated the economy. And we know he's a Keynesianist because he left us with a huge increase in the national debt, which doesn't come up that often, in spite of the fact that he also participates in tax increases. So, but that's not, I guess that's germane in the sense that there are different ways to stimulate the economy. Dumping money into the defense industry is one of the least multiplier effect ones. But I also wanted to, I don't know if your ProPublica people are looking at this, but when the bank bailout is talked about, it's talked about as the TARP money. But if you look at the Federal Reserve and the other ways that money was dumped into the banks, that is the hugest money that's been spent. I've heard it called twice the national GDP. And it's a little harder to track because it's opening the window of borrowing at just over zero. I forget exactly what it was. But that dwarfs the stimulant that you studied, and I assume that maybe the ProPublica or people who are looking at the way the banks are trying to negotiate limiting their liability for all of the financial fraud that they've had on their watch. So I guess I'm not really talking directly to your point, but it's clear that we did need a WPA, and as the earlier caller pointed out, that Roosevelt also got seduced by this deficit problem during when the Depression wasn't over, which history is repeats itself as farce. So, all right. Well, I had to interject that. Thank you.
And again, any comment that you, again, this is a little bit, this is certainly worthy of conversation, but a little bit different from the kind of thing that you spent so much time working on.
Right. And the book has a lot of different stories of folks who were affected or not affected by the recession. I met this one guy, his name is Terry Gunion, and he was a worker in Elkhart, Indiana, a home remodeler, who really suffered when the housing collapse happened. And he got so frustrated. He also lost his home in this and got so frustrated that he erected a sign saying, "Government bailouts don't work. You know, family with nine children put out, you know, essentially foreclosed upon." And there was a lot of anger as the stimulus was happening. And you know, there was even a shirt in the local flea market that said, "I want a bailout for me." And so the stimulus, with multiple explanation points, and so the stimulus was supposed to be the bailout for the regular person. People were angry over the bank bailout, and so this created this anticipation among the American public as to what the stimulus could do to really help them in their regular lives.
Well, just I hope people will, if they really want to have an in-depth treatment of this, I hope that they will look at the book, Money Well Spent. But is it possible to talk here for a couple of minutes and say, Is there some consensus of economists around the question of the impact? And are there particular things that people would point to as saying money was spent in a lot of different ways? Maybe it wasn't all spent well. But here we can say are some examples where it is generally thought the money was spent well and did have a positive effect. Can one point to some things?
Yeah. So I think we've talked about the nonpartisan forecasting firms have said that it created more than 2 million jobs. And that is nothing to sneeze at there. The other thing we saw was a battery industry in the U.S. for electric cars. I talked to a lot of plant owners and companies who said if it wasn't for this stimulus money, we wouldn't be building this plant in the U.S. We'd be building it overseas. So there's a lot of workers in this industry, somewhat fledgling. We don't know what the future holds for it, but it's kind of novel to see new manufacturing plants opening in the Rust Belt. We haven't seen things like that in years. Another successful program I'd point to is the Race to the Top program, and there may be a lot. This is for education reform, and there's a lot of debate about whether these programs will really work. But what the administration did was putting up this small amount of grant money, $5 billion, having states compete for it, was able to get a lot of things, get the states to pass a lot of reforms, like tying teacher pay to performance, putting data to use, lifting caps on charter schools, things that they wanted to happen. They were able to get this done without passing a major bill and having a long fight in Congress. So in terms of the administration's goals, that was a big success as well.
People, I'm sure, can find examples of spending in this plan that were silly, foolish, wasteful. I'm sure one can always find things like that if you look at the way the federal government spends or state government spends its money. Having said that, is there a lot of that? Is there much you can put under the heading of really stupid things where money went?
You know, it's all in perspective. I have a chapter in the book called One Man's Waste, where I go over many of these different programs. But, you know, a great project that I keep talking about is costumes for something called Bobber the Water Safety Dog. Bobber is an Army Corps of Engineers project or program to teach kids about boat and water safety. And so while I'm sure it has a good educational message and I'm sure it created jobs at the costume plant, you have to look at it on the perspective of the fact that construction unemployment in early 2010 was 27% unemployment rate, was the unemployment rate. Our infrastructure was graded to D. I'm sure the Army Corps of Engineers had a lot of bridges and levees and other things that needed some work. So all of these things have to be looked at in perspective, and that's sort of a good example of one of the many examples that I talk about.
Let's take a couple of calls here while we still have time. We'll go to Belgium. Line 4, hello.
Hello, and good morning. In your discussion earlier, before we kind of got off the sideline there, you were talking about the money goes in, and it generates jobs after jobs after jobs, and everybody gets a little bit more of the money, and even though you put $100 in, it looks like you got $1,000. But I think in this situation, we've also missed something here, that you shove $100 in, or $1,000, or whatever number you want to pick, and the government's done it so many times in the past, you push the money in there, but then the people who generate the jobs, the industrialists or whatever, they make sure they get plenty of profit. And I think at that point, a lot of this money disappears that people think gets turned over because the people, the very wealthy people, don't spend it like the very poor people. Could you speak to that?
Right. And this is a sort of a key argument that's been discussed in the stimulus, that if you give the money in food stamps, unemployment benefits, to people who typically don't have a lot of money to spend or save, that they would go ahead and put it right back into the economy. Whereas if you gave it to someone more wealthy or to a business that might save it, that money sits on the sidelines for a long, long time and can't be put to use to build or to cause economic stimulus.
I think, again, that though we're looking at this point of was this money spent in ways that were really dramatic that you could notice, or was it spent in ways that weren't so dramatic, maybe had positive benefit but weren't so dramatic? And I also think about the what I'm sure must have been the political necessity that said, well, everybody's got to get something. So the money was spread far, but it was also spread thin. And it could be that, in fact, there might have been bigger impact if you targeted it a little bit more to the places that needed it. So give more money to the places that needed it more, or do it in a way that would have greater impact. And in fact, that didn't happen. And that did that further dilute the effect of the spending?
Yeah, the spending was very scattershot, so there wasn't any specific focus in the money to Florida or Arizona, places hit by the housing crisis, or to the Midwest that had seen a long manufacturing decline. I say in the book that the stimulus money was spread out like peanut butter, and they tried to make the stimulus a cure-all for everything. Every one of society's ills got some sort of money, whether it was cancer research or Kogan grass in the South, as invasive species, a weed. The one area where you did see a lot of money concentrated and where you definitely saw the stimulus happen, I read about Aiken, South Carolina, which is home to a Cold War nuclear plant that needed cleanup. And about $1.6 billion went into a contract to do this work, and they hired about 3,000, 4,000 workers into this small community. So they saw a lot of work there. And what was really interesting to see from a political perspective was that this area is a deep red Republican region, went solidly for McCain in 2008. But I spoke to the local chamber of commerce, I spoke to the mayor and the city manager, and they were all very positive about the stimulus in seeing that how it had filled up all of their apartment stock, all of their hotels, the restaurants were busy, the gas stations were busy. So you could really see a tremendous stimulus effect when all this money was concentrated in one area. Hmm.
Was it also the case that people had been in the administration, they saw the plan had its shortcomings, maybe they should have been spending more money, that they somehow thought that this wouldn't be the be-all, end-all. It wouldn't be a one-shot deal for them, that they somehow would have an opportunity to take a second pass, and that, in fact, politics meant that was never going to happen.
Right. One of the little appreciated aspects of the stimulus was that there were two things. It wasn't just about trying to deal with the current economic recession. There was also this part about reinvestment and trying to build a new foundation for the economy through things like clean energy, high-speed rail, broadband, education reform. But all of these things were intended to be a down payment, and this was somewhat predicated on the optimism the administration had that the public would continue to support these ideas, and that the politics in Congress would continue to support these ideas. So as a result, the stimulus they underestimated the damage that a stimulus could do. A stimulus that did not have immediate effects, or was only short term, could do, because all these things are now seen as toxic. You know, clean energy had a lot of support in 2008. But now, anytime anyone thinks about clean energy, the Republicans mention Solyndra. And so while the stimulus wasn't enough money to transform the energy sector infrastructure, it was just enough amount of money for Republicans to be able to say, we tried that already.
Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to wrap up maybe just a tiniest bit early, because we at noon today we'll have live coverage of our governor's giving his State of the State message. And I have a couple of callers. My apologies, we won't be able to take. But certainly, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that our guest Michael Graybell has written. The title of his book is Money Well Spent: The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, the Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. Public Affairs is the publisher. Michael Graybell is a reporter at ProPublica, and if you'd like to find out more about ProPublica and what it's all about and the various things that they have reported on, you can go to their website, which is ProPublica.org. And Mr. Graybell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show that we first presented on February 1st. And this is a program that you can find on our web archive. In fact, a lot of shows are there on the archive. So if you'd like to catch up on something that you might have missed, or perhaps you'd like to go back and do a repeat listening, it's all there and it's ready for you anytime that you like. So what you need to do is go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can search through the programs there. That way also, you can get the schedule for upcoming programs, and let me tell you about what we'll be doing tomorrow. In the first hour, this is an archive. Both shows tomorrow are archives. This is an archive conversation that I had with one of America's leading scholars of East Asia. His name is Ezra Vogel. He's an emeritus professor of social sciences at Harvard and is the author of a very well-known, very influential book. It was published in 1979. The book was titled Japan as Number One, and it's a book that got a lot of attention because it predicted the rise of Japan as an economic powerhouse. So we talked about that. It's talked about some of the book's impact, but we also talked about his most recent book, and this is a book that looks at China's development and the role that Deng Xiaoping played in that country's modernization. And in that conversation, he said he thought that the first book, the book about Japan, really played a role in educating America about Japan, and his hope is that the new book would do the same for China. And I was really pleased to have the opportunity to meet and talk with him. He was on a visit to the campus of the University of Illinois. Then in the second hour, a rather different subject, and this is about green energy. If you go back to 1900, you will find that there were places where people were using the sun to heat water for their homes. They could ride across New York City in an electric cab. In 1945, you could have bought a solar home or a 1 megawatt wind turbine. So that technology has been around for a while. In fact, green technology has been viable for more than a century. So the question is, why aren't we using it? So this was a show that is conversation with a guy named Alexis Madrigal. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and we were talking about a book that he has written. The title of the book is Powering the Dream, and that explores some of the history of green technology, and you can read about it in great detail in the book, much more than we really were able to go into in the conversation. But it's there in the book, Powering the Dream, and he really says that if you understand that history and look at that history, he says, well, that history really has the potential to reshape the way that we think about energy right now. So that's the programs that you'll hear tomorrow. They're, again, from the Focus Archives, and you can go and see what we're doing by looking at the Focus section of our website. That is wyll.illinois.edu.
WILL invites you to meet Alan J.W. Bell, director and producer of England's longest-running television comedy, Last of the Summer Wine. Alan is a great teller of tales. Don't miss his behind-the-scenes stories and video. Join us at Campbell Hall on Friday, March 23rd at 5:30 p.m. A $50 per person donation is requested. To make a pledge and receive admission as your thank you, phone 217-244-9455.
WILL agricultural programs and services are made possible by the Friends of WILL and by Bates Commodities, Anderson's Incorporated, AgriGold Hybrids, and Wisconsin Plastic Drain Tile. Thank you for your continued support.
Well, coming up next, we have news, features, weather, sports, some ag numbers, all of that. It's part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host.
And we'll get underway with those commodity prices. In Kansas City, May wheat trading at 681 and a half, up one. July 690, up one half. May wheat, Chicago, 641 and a quarter, down one and a quarter. July, 650 and three quarters, down three quarters. May corn, 643 and a half, down four. July, 642 and three quarters. Make that 643 now, latest tick, down three. September, 586 and a half, down four and a quarter. December, 557 and a quarter, down three. May soybeans, 1351, up six. July, 1358 and a half, up six and a quarter. August, 1351, up seven and a half. September, 1333 and three quarters, up nine and three quarters. May soybean meal, 368 even, that's up 240. May oil, 5447, up 14. April live cattle, 125.27 and a half, up 75. June, 122.45, up $1. March feeder cattle, 153.70, up 97 and a half. April, 153.52 and a half, up 105. April lean hogs, 85.07 and a half, that is up 12 and a half. Outside markets, May crude 107.02, up 95. The U.S. dollar 79.69, up 10. The CRB index 316.44. That is up 91. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was off 11 points at 13,159. The NASDAQ up 12 at 3087. And the S&P 500 up a point at 1406. It's noon Central Time. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.com.